inverted L. It's approximately 40 feet long. It has a 30-foot counter dropping down vertically to counterpoise. It's about 40 and 75 meters. He's using a 9-to-1 balance, 9-to-1 on unbalance, and he wants to know if he could build one like that for transmitting with a tuner. If you think that would work, and maybe you could give him some help on how to run it down. That's basically his question. Back to you, Dick.
The answer is absolutely yes. All antennas obey reciprocity. That means what gain, efficiency, pattern, front-to-back ratio, standing wave ratio, all of that jazz that you get in the receive mode. With rare exception, almost every antenna will give you the exact same performance in the transmit mode. So as long as you've used high enough power components, anything you call a receiving antenna can be used for transmitting. The biggest example of an exception to that I can think of is a ferrite loop stick. The ferrite loop stick you've got in the middle of your handheld transistorized radio is a very good receiving antenna. And could you transmit back through that? Yeah, probably a fraction of a watt you could transmit into it, because it's such an extremely small antenna. It's got some rather fine wiring. You try putting 100 watts in that, and of course it's going to be smoke and flames real fast. But there's ways you can beef that up to make it a transmitting antenna. But when it comes to these small loop-like antennas, every one of those can be used for a transmitter as long as you are smart enough to calculate what voltage is going to occur across that great big air variable tuning capacitor that makes that loop resonate. In the case of an L-type long wire antenna, depending on the length of your wire, you can go to the Brown and Woodward curves and make a very good guess. The fact that some of it is a vertical 30-foot section and a horizontal 40-foot section, it really is a 70-foot long piece of wire. The fact that you've got a right angle bend in it is a fairly minor effect. Let me drop it. So it's the pure length of that wire at the frequencies where you're using it. The Brown and Woodward curves will allow you to make an extremely good estimation as to what is the real impedance, the resistive and the reactive component of impedance on each of your frequencies. And can you now make an impedance matching network by way of the Berkeley program? You Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, and you get this beautiful program that you plug in the real resistive component and the reactive component and the frequency you were operating, and you press go, and in 1 second that program gives you 15 solutions. Choose the one that you like with all the values and the schematic diagrams of them. And for you to wind your own inductor and to make your own capacitor or choose the right capacitor that works at a impedance matching device, can you put a kilowatt in that antenna? Absolutely. So any wire-like antenna, you can by various means, you can make a rough approximation as to the impedance by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, or you can borrow somebody's antenna analyzer, or use a vector network analyzer, but by way of the measuring instruments, you can measure the exact impedance of that antenna, and anything that you can measure the impedance or calculate the impedance on, can you make an impedance matching network? Absolutely. And how high power should the wire be to take the current that's in the loading coil, and how much air space you should have in the plates of the air variable tuning capacitor to make sure you don't arc it over, all of that is calculatable. So you can put 1,500 watts into any of these kinds of antennas if you know what you're doing. There's nothing magic about an antenna that says it's only a receiving antenna and you can't transmit to it, with a slight exception. Let me drop it. That ferrite loop stick antenna is the one exception I can think of, because it's got rather fine wiring and rather small size. To transmit into it anything more than a fraction of a watt is going to get you some trouble. MFR, looks like Mike came back to us. Go ahead, Mike. K2MFR, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2MFR, yeah, I just caught you, just came back in. What I have is a 45-foot wire from my window to a tree. It's the only space I can get for anything. onto a 9-to-1 unun. And then I have a counterpoise wire going down about 20 or so feet, and then running along the ground for another maybe 20 or so feet. My question is, on these NFED type end with a random wire, what I need, is that what I would need, a 9-to-1 unun? Or, and I know they're not that efficient, but my question is, can I make that workable? Because it's the only option I really have. I rent, and I only have one tree.
Your main question is, can you indeed dispatch that slightly unusual antenna arrangement that you just described? The answer is absolutely yes. Your secondary question is a 9-to-1 and unun the right solution? That's iffy. Your 9-to-1 is taking your 50 ohms and converting it to, 450 ohms. And if your antenna is in the vicinity of 450 ohms of total impedance, that onion is going to do a fairly good job. There are certain lengths of wire at your particular operating frequency where it becomes close to a half wave of wire, and you're feeding the outer end of that wire, you can easily have 1,500 or 2,000 ohms of impedance. There's nothing magic about feeding a dipole in the center, a half-wave dipole. If you decide to feed it out at one end, you might see 2,000 ohms. 2,000 ohms is a very impedance to match if you got the right kind of a L network to do it. Is an unknown the right way to do it? Maybe not, because the unknown is giving you 450 ohms as an output impedance, and you're looking for 2,000. Now, that's not so bad. The difference between 450 ohms and 2,000 is about a 4.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. If your unknown is made for a kilowatt, and you're putting 150 watts into it, and it's got a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, it'll laugh at you and keep right on going. Let me drop. But if your unknown is rated for 500 watts into a matched system, and you've now got this unmatched system of a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio of my particular example, and now you put a kilowatt into that, it's going to turn into a charred mess. So an unknown is a good step in the right direction to give you the high impedance of an open wire end, of an infed wire antenna. But now, what is the real impedance and what kind of a network you should be using? You have the resources to calculate and measure that. So if you want to, and if you're starting to run high power and you're worried about burning up your unknown, you can go the next step to investigate what is the real impedance of your antenna. Mike, K2MFR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I was just wondering if there's any truth to, I was looking at Ballon Designs, I don't know if you heard of them. They make different kind of unknowns and balance. And what they say is that you can put a 9-to-1 and a certain length of wire, they give you the different lengths, that you can make an end fed on that. And I guess the counterpoise would be the coax, but I want to run my own counterpoise. But I don't have any equipment to measure the impedance. So I guess going by their numbers might be snake oil. Back to you. You two on the phone.
I wouldn't call it snake oil, Mike. For many circumstances, somewhat similar to yours, the 9-to-1 onion does a pretty good job. And by the way, does your 9-to-1 onion, does it have, what is its power rating in watts? Let's go with that one first. What is the power rating on that thing in watts, Mike? Go ahead.
Well, right now it's just a receive. I can't use this one. I got this before I upgraded to general. And now I am a general, so I want to get it transmitting. I have two different options that I was looking at, and they have a dual core, and one is rated at a kilowatt, one's rated at, they call it QRP, 200-300 watts. So I'm looking to buy the appropriate thing just to make it work.
EPZ in the comment. And one final question for you, Mike. How many watts do you intend to transmit into this thing? Over to you, Mike.
getting it?
100 watts, 100 watts.
You are getting it. If you only intend to transmit 100 watts and you're buying an onion rated for 500 watts, and in the example I just gave, you're going to be feeding it with 4.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. Your 100 watts into a matched 450-ohm load with your 9-to-1 onion would be very happy. It would run very cool. You run a 4.5-to-1 standing wave ratio, your 100 watts into the onion, thinks it's a lot higher than 100 watts because it's now transmitting either higher voltages or higher current because of the standing wave ratio. And therefore, it's going to run warmer. Will it take the 100 watts? My gut feels the answer is yes. But it sounds to me like this exact situation, Hal has already studied it. He's going to tell us what the right answer is. K6DPZ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Hal.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. I just want to say a first high update on that. Okay, Mike, you mentioned you don't have impedance measuring equipment. I'm going to tell you a very easy way to make an impedance measuring device. You ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
You need a grid dip meter, you need a 5K carbon resistor, and you need an RF probe with a digital voltmeter. Okay, you got that so far?
I have the voltmeter. That's about it. In other words, I would have to measure the impedance first before I do anything, correct?
Tell you how you can measure the impedance. You get a value for that impedance.
I get what you're saying. I guess I just have to borrow something to measure it. I don't really have the time to find this stuff, and I have very limited time as well as space.
Very easy. You need a 5,000 ohm carbon resistor, a grid dip meter, a VOM with a low RF probe. The only thing you do, you take your grid dip meter set for the frequency you want to measure the impedance of your unknown circuit, okay, RF circuit. Then you take this RF probe and you measure the voltage drop across the resistor and across your unknown load. When both voltage drops are equal, by adjusting the resistor, measure the DC resistance of the resistor and it is the impedance of your unknown.
That's going to give you the right impedance if it's a resistive load. It's a highly reactive load and you want to impedance match it. The matching procedure could be a little bit more complicated now. Over to you on that one, Hal. K2RIW.
Reactive load, Dick. I've done it. And it works. You drive the system with a grid dip meter, so you have an RF source. And then you measure the RF voltage drop across the pot, and you balance the pot to the RF voltage drop across your unknown reactive load. And you then take the pot out, measure the resistance of the pot, and the impedance of the reactive load.
Hal, you skipped over a whole lot of steps. You never even told him how he takes the resonating coil sitting on the front end of a grid dip meter. How does he couple that to his antenna? To you, that's something you've done many times, and you don't even bother mentioning it. You didn't tell him how to do that. Over to you, Hal.
You link couple your grid dip meter with about 2-3 turns near the grid dip meter's coil. Then you have your 5K carbon pot and your unknown load, and then back returning. The main thing you want to obtain is you want to measure the voltage drop across the unknown load and the voltage drop across the carbon resistance, RF voltage drop, when they are equal by adjusting the pot. Then you take the pot out, measure that resistance, you'll be impedance with the looking into.
And if the answer came out 150 ohms, how do you know whether or not it's 150 ohms of resistance, or 150 ohms of reactance, or some other combination? How do you know that one, Hal? Over to you, K2RIW.
The fumes are a reactive component. Dude, it works. Trust me, I've done it many times.
If his antenna was 150 ohms of reactance and 30 ohms of resistance, and he measured 150 ohms on that resistor, he thought it was a resistance of 150 ohms, but it was primarily reactive. Wouldn't that change the answer?
Must have measured the antenna without going through a coaxial cable right at the antenna drive points there. Is that what I understood? And you'd have an accurate impedance point that you're measuring on the antenna. Without a coax. I was saying directly at the antenna. If it's end fed, at the end fed point. If it's center fed, at the center fed point.
As you guys can tell, there's a slight difference of opinion here as to what I think I'm hearing and what Hal is saying. My strongest recommendation in this particular case is that, Mike, you have resources you don't realize. By way of the club you join, by way of a club like Limock, for instance, somebody out there will loan you an impedance analyzer. When you connect the impedance analyzer to your antenna at the point where you're normally feeding it, at the onion, for instance, and you measure the real impedance, and then you go to the Berkeley curve, Berkeley program, it'll tell you how to homebrew a perfect impedance matching device. Depending on what answer you get, if your antenna analyzer tells you that you've got 450 ohms, then your 9-to-1 onion is perfect. But that's only going to be true at one of those frequencies. At each of the frequencies where you want to use your L-type antenna with its L-type counterpoise, you're going to get a different impedance on each one of those frequencies. An antenna analyzer is going to give you an exact answer, and it's a little bit easier. How is able to do this, to have somebody do it for the first time, is not so easy, in my opinion. I think as you listen to Hal's suggestion, my guess is you feel a little bit uncomfortable with that one, is my guess, Mike. K2MFR, K2RIW, the TechNet.
2RIW, K2MFR. Yeah, I think an antenna analyzer would be a lot easier. So, like, a friend of mine just got, he got it actually off eBay. It's a NFED antenna. He threw it up in his tree, and he's getting out on 40, 80. He's getting out on all bands with a tuner. He's getting out low, but people can hear him in Virginia and so forth, where some of our friends are. So my question is, he just threw it up. So the right way to do it would be to measure everything first. This way I don't have any problems, like direct.
An analyzer is the easiest way to do it. So if you don't have an antenna analyzer, you have a grid dip meter, you have a couple little components, and you can do the job. But if you've got an analyzer, it saves all the steps.
Except for the fact that you might cook an onion that's not mated, not rated for your particular power level, for your particular visor, except for that case of the onion, the wire itself, you're not going to burn it up. If you happen to have an antenna tuner that will match your antenna, you're home free. You made it sound like until you make this measurement, you can't possibly transmit into it. I don't think it's anywhere near that severe. You're not going to burn up a piece of wire, if you know what I mean. And the antenna tuner itself, if it's in the shack with you and it's starting to run warm, by you smelling it, you'll know right away. And even the same thing with the onion. If it's in the shack with you, you'll know about that. So could you transmit ahead of time for brief periods of time to do a test and then start extending it to longer periods of time before you do all of the measuring and analyzing? I say yes. We amateurs, from time to time, we take a leap of faith and transmit into an antenna. And as long as you've got a little bit of smart as to what kind of power level your components can tolerate, you can usually get away with it. That's my opinion. Over to you, Mike, K2MFR, K2RIW.
Okay, thanks. I recorded all this so I could go back and research a few things, and I'm gonna try it. Thank you for the information, and thanks for the great net. Back to you, Dick, K2RIW, K2MFR.
Yeah, Mike, make a leap of faith. You don't have very much danger in what you're doing. It's not going to burn up the transmitter. They've got built-in protection circuits. as long as you've got a power rated onion, that's a good guess as to an impedance match. But the Berkeley program will give you a much better match, or a good antenna tuner that has wide tuning range will definitely do the job. As you start running these experiments, and whether it works or doesn't work, please come back periodically and let us know what you find. Because where you are, a lot of guys are there and don't know it, or they don't know that they, even in a restricted environment like you're in, where you could put up a relatively simple antenna and make it work rather well, you're doing a darn good experiment. Lots of guys would like to hear what you're doing. So come back and let us know. K2MFR for any final. K2RIW the TechNet.
Nice, that's all the information I need. I appreciate it. Oh, one more thing. With the onion at the window and about 5 feet of coax running to the tuner, would I need a choke so I don't get any RF in the shack?
I think the answer is no. An onion is a fairly good isolation transformer. The chances of it giving you RF in the shack is fairly low, not zero, but even if you get some RF in the shack, it's not the end of the world. There is ways you can sense it, measure it, and do corrective action when you see it. Cross that bridge when you come to it. A brave man dies but once, but a coward dies many times. It's not the end of the world if you get some RF in the shack, Mike. It's not going to create smoke and flames. K2MFR, K2RIW.
Okay, thanks. I have some pretty good information here, and I'm going to proceed and try this stuff. Thanks for all the information, and back to net, K2MFR.
Time for the next question, John. KC2WGB, the man with the web mailbag, and the man monitoring the echo link, K2RIW. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Perfect, good thing. I'm glad we got Mike's question in there and that he was around, because it would have been a little difficult for him if he would have had to tune in again next week to ask further questions. But, all right. I have a question here from Kilo Charlie 2, Golf Uniform Z. Another drop. He posted this question in the chat room a little late last week. I couldn't get it in, but he's heard you speak about the RF envelope once transmitted travels to every point in space in the universe. His question is, what do you think happens to it when it hits the end of the universe? Do you think it's reflected back in, kept within this universe, or do you think it goes beyond? I'd like to hear your land on that if you have one. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, darn good question. I've got a fairly strong feeling on this one. I don't guarantee I'm right. As I said, I've got a fairly strong feeling. Everything I read about astronomy, and particularly if you take the latest issue of Scientific American, I'm talking about, let's see now, it's the one that arrived October at my house, and this is, I presume, yeah, the November issue, November 2015, has some beautiful space articles. And as you read these articles, you'll suddenly realize that what we call the observable universe, 13.7 billion light years of distance, even if that was the end of the universe, if only the observable universe was the end, and the signal that you and I transmit goes out there, it ain't going to hit the end until 13.7 billion years takes place. And then if it reflected back, another 13.7 billion years to get back to your shack. Don't hold your breath on that one. However, there ain't no end to this universe. Everything I read leads me to believe it literally goes on forever. And it doesn't curve back on itself. So let me drop it. I'm convinced that every signal we transmit goes forever in every single direction. Goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. And if you've got the right kind of the measuring equipment, you can measure that signal. That signal coming back from Voyager, because Voyager is 12 billion miles away, three times the distance to Pluto, is really out there. That is the longest range piece of hardware that mankind has ever created. and it's going to be a zillion years before we tap that one, if you know what I mean. That signal experiences something like 300 decibels of insertion loss between that 8 or 10 foot dish on Voyager and the 240 foot dish at Goldstone, California, that will receive that signal. In between the two is roughly 300 decibels of loss. The best antenna chamber that I have ever seen, worked on, or read about is the 100 decibel tempest proof chamber at Edwards Air Force Base that I've worked on way back in 1990. Any signal that within the frequency range where that chamber is rated that you transmit on the outside of that chamber, the signal gets through those walls and into that side of that inside of the chamber, is 100 decibels weaker. That's a 10 million to 1 ratio. If I built 3 of those chambers inside of each other, each is 100 dB of attenuation, and you build another chamber inside the first one and another chamber inside the first one, now I would approach 300 dB of loss. That's what we are already overcoming when it comes to listening to Voyager. By using the right hardware, we're overcoming 300 dB of loss. That gives you a beautiful example of the furthest signal, and that, by the way, is a QRP signal. It's roughly a 6-watt signal being transmitted by Voyager. The signal at the speed of light takes 17 hours one way to go from Voyager to the Earth. You say, "Hello, Voyager," and Voyager answers you. It takes 35 hours for the signal to come back, round trip time. So, does the signal go everywhere? Absolutely. No matter how weak the signal is, you use the right equipment, you can receive that signal. And does it go out there and reflect off something and come back? I say absolutely not. Assume it doesn't reflect, because there's nothing out there to reflect. You would be amazed how sparse space really is. The example I've given, people worry about when you're sending out a signal, it's going to be bouncing off all of the planets. Let me drop it. You heard my example of the 50 cent piece and the dime. If I'm making a scale model of this solar system, because Mars is half the diameter of the Earth, and if I use as my scale model a dime and a 50 cent piece, because they're roughly 2 to 1 in ratio, throughout most of the year, to place that dime and a 50 cent piece in my scale model, there would have to be something like half a mile apart. So when NASA issues a spacecraft from the Earth, which is the 50 cent piece, and a half a mile away, it lands on the right letter on that dime. That's what you're really doing. That gives you some idea of the accuracy. But as you can tell, there's nothing in between the two but a hell of a lot of empty space. And that's the dense portion of the solar system. The four inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, are very densely packed together, and still you can see this tremendous amount of empty space between them. And then you go to the outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. They are tremendously further apart than the dense ones in the middle. So you think your signal's going to go out there and bounce off this stuff? There's almost nothing there most of the time, if you know what I mean. And our solar system is itself a very densely packed portion of the local universe compared to the nearest star, 4.5 light years away, and nothing but empty space in between the two. And if that nearest star had another solar system, boy, what distances there are between them. So you can assume that any... Let me drop it.
AC2BY2 is common.
Ed, recognize, you can assume that any signal you and I transmit is going to go out there and almost never come back to reflect. Ed, go right ahead with your comments on this. K2RIW in the TechNet.
There's another effect at work here as well, which is that the universe, as we've seen through our telescopes, is expanding. So imagine you fire off your radio wave and it travels to another galaxy. Imagine you've got some huge mirror in that other galaxy and it reflects your radio wave back to you. Well, as your radio wave travels across to that other galaxy, those, on a cosmological scale, everything is kind of pushing apart from one another. You've got local effects where, you know, galaxies are moving closer to each other. But if you were talking about on a cosmological scale, going to the, you know, way, 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 way deep into the universe and bouncing back, what will end up happening is your signal will get redshifted down to nothing, where redshift is the, in fact, it's basically Doppler shift. It is Doppler shift. So as these, you know, different cosmological bodies are moving away from one another, the signals that they see from one another get redshifted farther and farther, lower in frequency. And so by the time, assuming even that you did manage to reflect a signal powerful enough to reach across, you know, some mega cluster and back, it would be redshifted down to nothing.
And nothing is a little bit severe, down to a much, much lower frequency, a much, much longer wavelength. I'll accept that. And by the way, the nearest galaxy to us, the Andromeda Galaxy, is not drifting away from us, it's approaching us. For the first 8 billion light years, the material out there is slightly decelerating. Beyond 8 billion light years, out to 13.5, is where the acceleration takes place. So it's the outer perimeter of this observable universe that is accelerating away from us. But the stuff nearby is actually slowing down a little bit in the rate at which it's drifting away by way of the Hubble constant. So the whole situation is a little bit more complicated. They've come up with some brand new hardware that you read about in the November issue, Scientific American, 2015, where they're now starting to make higher and higher resolution measurements. They're really looking at the radial distribution of matter and its velocities and its ranges, as well as the azimuth and elevation spatial distribution. So there's a lot more to be measured as to what's really going on here. But you can rest assured, let me drop, that the radio signals that we send out, even if there was a supersized mirror at Andromeda, 2.5 million light years away from us. So even that supersized light, that mirror on Andromeda, you would get a blue shift from it because it's approaching us. However, 2.5 million light years of distance, 5 million light years round trip, even that nearby galaxy, the nearest one, or one of the most nearest ones, awful long time for you to get that return. So, interesting to discuss, but not necessarily practical. The long-delayed echoes that hams have experienced, where sometimes you transmit a signal and it comes back to you 5, 10, 15 seconds later, very difficult to explain that. But enough people have seen it on rare occasions to make sure that it really appears to be real, and explaining that is not easy. KC2WGB, K2LIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB, it's wonderful how we solve all these problems. Oh boy, we got answers. Interesting stuff. All right, let me let it drop like one to the next one. All right, Dick, this gentleman, youngster, 16 years old, he's found an auto tuner which covers 10 through 80 meters. It'll handle 500 watts. It is severely damaged. All of the electronics are burned. The meters are broken, and the case is crushable. But the roller inductor and the capacitors are still in pristine condition and can be removed on the little mount chassis that it's mounted on. Is there a way that he could hook that up and use it as a manual tuner to cover those bands? It's quite an expensive piece, and the roller inductor and capacitors, they're beautiful. They're really nice. It almost looks like the roller inductor is made out of silver-plated copper tube or something. That's a really nice thing. Maybe you can give him a tip on how he should try to hook that up, what he should look for, and maybe what he should be careful about. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Now, I'm going to make a guess that the automatic antenna tuner had some kind of a motor that automatically operated that roller inductor. Had another motor that operated the variable air capacitors. And it was a really expensive one. Maybe it was even a Jennings micro variable capacitor. You know, Jennings vacuum variable capacitors. So rather than have these burnt out motors and burnt out electronics run those, can you do that manually? Absolutely. You might not even have to do any rewiring. All you have to do is some mechanical work and a shaft that allows you to turn that roller inductor just like the motor normally does, and add a shaft that turns the variable capacitor just like its motor does, then the current layout of the RF, as far as the way the transmitted signal goes into this antenna tuner and comes out of it, that wiring up might be in good shape. So to make it manual, absolutely. And there are schematic diagrams you can find in the older radio amateurs' handbooks as to how to homebrew an antenna tuner. However, you've already got that, if you know what I mean. So to make it manual and bypass all that circuitry, absolutely, that can be done. And as long as they've used reasonable quality for the transmitting components, let me drop quick. Without putting 30 kilowatts in there, you probably cannot burn up an antenna tuner. And even the variable capacitors that are in the antenna tuner, even if you've arced over the air spacing between them with high-power transmitters improperly set, even that is not a permanent damage. It may have made some rough spots, and you can file down the rough spots on the variable capacitor air-spaced plates. So is that reusable? Absolutely. So even though all the electronics is gone, as far as the automatic tuning function is concerned, can you do it manually? Absolutely. By way of, you may have to add your own directional coupler. It may have to be homebrew, because now how do you know when it's set correctly? To adjust the antenna tuner to maximize the voltage delivered to the unknown antenna and its transmission line. Usually when you maximize the voltage going up the antenna, you're going in the right direction of adjusting the antenna tuner. It's hard to believe, but maximum voltage usually is the best tuning. You're doing an impedance match when you do that. So some kind of a voltage sensing circuit that can measure forward voltage or maximum voltage itself will tell you when you're going in the right direction. And if you had the next step, let me drop. It'd be nice to be able to measure the reflected voltage, but that's mostly academic. To know how high the standing wave ratio of your antenna is, it's kind of nice to know. But if your antenna tuner doesn't run out of range, and if it'll give you maximum voltage delivered, you're there. And you may have to run your transmitter into a low power mode while you're doing the adjusting, because until you hit the right tuning and loading controls on your antenna tuner, until you hit those right adjustments, your transmitter is going to see high standing wave ratio and it's going into a self-protect mode. Maybe your transmitter is good for 100 watts. If you dial it back to the 1 watt mode, in the 1 watt power output mode of your transmitter, it will not go into a self-protect mode. In the 1 watt mode, it can look into a short circuit and keep cranking out that 1 watt, if you know what I mean. So in that means, you'd be able to set the tuning of the antenna tuner, and once you arrive at the right tuning, you can then step the power back up, and the transmitter will be happy. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the tech net. And as he does these further experiments, please ask him to come back and tell us what he found out. You've got it, John.
Can I make a quick comment? WHCDL.
Hey, Andy, very good. Yes, Dick, and I was thinking of maybe a dual directional coupler, or we could use two couplers fairly close in value, and you know, reverse one of them, and you would be able to get that with a simple detector and a very simple meter on each one. Andy, go ahead, sir.
Also a comment from KC2SHO.
EZ also has a comment.
You got it, Andy.
Okay, good evening. I rarely talk. I do a lot of listening. I would just think, and just to mention, that if this is one of those automatic motorized antenna tuner that's got motors to adjust coils, capacitors, and anything else. I would assume it's got built in an automatic SWR sensing circuit that would see the reflected power and know when it's tuned. So obviously the motors would then stop once it reaches its proper tuning location. I guess I'm just saying is if it's an automatic antenna tuner, it probably has that directional coupler and all those electronics already built in, and maybe that part of it is not damaged and can be used again. What do you think?
The directional coupler itself is very hard to burn up. It can tolerate a lot. But it's got some rectifying diodes in there, which maybe they got damaged. The way it was described to us, an awful lot of the electronics in this automatic antenna tuner are fried, and the meters are smashed. So this thing has really been through a war. But the main basic impedance matching circuitry, the variable capacitors and the roller inductor, with rare exception, I can't believe that has been damaged. And even if it has been physically damaged, it's probably fixable. So I guarantee there's a lot that can be used here. I wonder if Hal has run into a similar situation. K16PZ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Hal.
IW in the group, K16PZ. First question I have, is he using this tuning system with a tube transmitter or a solid-state transmitter? That's the first question I want answered.
Hal, that information I don't have.
I say that doesn't matter. Even if it's a solid-state transmitter, if he dials it back to the 1-watt output mode while he's doing the tuning, it will not trip out, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Hal.
Okay, well, you assume it's solid state. Now, let's assume it's a tube transmitter. Now, here's the best procedure to get around with the tube transmitter. Take the tube transmitter, tune it into a 50-ohm load for proper power output. Once you have the transmitter tuned into a 50-ohm load for proper power output, back the carrier signal of the tube transmitter down without touching the tuning, plate tuning, or loading control. Just back it down, go through a standing wave meter and this tuner that he wants to put together. Bring up a little bit of carrier without touching the adjustments on the transmitter, and then null out the standing wave on the tuner, and then pour the coil to it. Best broadcast procedure we've used for years.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I like that. When it comes to adjusting the antenna tuner for the right tuning settings, Hal just gave you one of the ways, one of the really good ways. When the antenna tuner is working correctly, if it's designed for a 50-ohm transmitter, then the input impedance of that antenna tuner will be a 50-ohm resistor, and you will not see any standing wave ratio. Simultaneously, if you're looking at the voltage output of the antenna tuner going into your antenna, you also recognize that the voltage going into your antenna has been maximized. So, whether you tune for maximum voltage output or minimum standing wave ratio of input to the antenna tuner, that's your choice, depending on what instrumentation you got. They both will give you the exact same answer. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
It's good, Dick. I believe there was another station with a comment. Maybe you want to pick it up.
Was there another station? If so, give us your call letters and name right now. I don't think so. You got it, John.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I think he could have a lot of fun, and that would be useful. And that's a good tip, Hal. And I think he should proceed. He's got nothing to lose. It's a low wattage to get it going, check everything out. I don't think you can damage anything, whether it's all the or tubes. Just be careful and go slow. Okay, now, I had a question, Dick, of my own that you forgot to cover me, so got time, I'll ask that question. It's a quick one.
No, we're out of time, John. We've got to move on. That's a joke. Sorry, I forgot you. You got it, John. Take your time.
This is a question. question, a design question on slotted line. As you know, I've been experimenting with it. Now, my question is, slotted line, waveguide beyond cutoff at its design frequency. Is that, especially, I'm talking about the 805 HP, as you know. Would that be something you would believe in?
Okay. Now is the time to give a little bit of discussion to what is meaning waveguide beyond cutoff. If I had a real piece of rectangular waveguide, and you study the way it works, it's got an X dimension and a Y dimension. In other words, it's got a width and a height. When you look at the cross section of the waveguide, when you're above the minimum frequency for that waveguide, that horizontal dimension, the maximum dimension of the waveguide, must be greater than a half wavelength in air at your operating frequency. That width has got to be more than the width of a half wavelength. Every piece of waveguide is the world's best high-pass filter. You go to a lower frequency where it's no longer a half wavelength of width, that signal will go down that waveguide about 1 inch, and that's it, and it dies. It's the world's best attenuator. And there's ways you can calculate exactly how much attenuation, how many dBs per inch you get. It's a great big number when you're at too low a frequency. Now, the way the Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line is made, let me drop. It is really a coaxial structure. It's not waveguide. It's got a real center conductor, and it's got a real outer conductor. But the craziness of the outer conductor, it's not round. It's two vertical flat plates, exactly 2 centimeters apart. Coaxial cable. Almost all the coax cable we've ever used has a round center conductor and a round outer conductor, and a certain spacing between the two, a certain ratio of those diameters. And when that ratio is something like 2.3 to 1, we call it a 50 ohm impedance coaxial cable. There's nothing magic about the center conductor being round. The center conductor can be square, a triangle, a strip line. It can be all kinds of shapes. The outer conductor doesn't have to be round. It can be square, a triangle, a six-sided box, whatever. And the center conductor doesn't have to be exactly in the center. All of those are a good low-loss transmission line if you build it correctly. Now, if you create a slot in that outer conductor along the linear length of the transmission line, for the most part, that slot will not radiate. And whether or not you put a slot on the top and a slot on the bottom of the coax cable, in other words, at the 6 o'clock point and the 12 o'clock point, that's your choice. So the way Hewlett-Packard manufactured this thing is they got these two flat plates. I don't know the exact number, but they're probably something like 5 inches wide. They're something like a foot and a half long, and these two flat plates are 2 centimeters apart. And the center conductor, a round rod, goes down the center of that. Doesn't look like it. That is a coaxial cable. Only when the signal sees that 2 centimeter spacing as a half wavelength.
Repeater, timeout.
To repeat, only when your signal is high enough in frequency that the 2 centimeter spacing between the two flat plates is a half wavelength or more, which is going to be something like 5 gigahertz. If you try to use that slotted line above 5 gigahertz, in theory, you could get a little bit of radiation out of the spacing between those two plates as a slot antenna. However, even that wouldn't take place, because that would only take place if you put a differential voltage between the two plates. The differential voltage between the two plates would only occur if you're putting a signal down the center conductor and the center conductor is not centered. You put the center conductor off to one side. You know, you reach down there with your great big screwdriver and you bend that center conductor so it's now a bow, so it's now closer to one plate, and now you put some transmitting signal down that center conductor. Now you're launching a differential signal between the two plates and it'll radiate. But because it's so well centered, it's not making a differential voltage. As such, you could use that slotted line at 10 gigahertz.
where in theory it has the ability to radiate out that slot, but you haven't created a differential voltage between those two plates, it will not radiate out that slot. So that slotted line is good from at least DC to 10 gigahertz if you're careful, and if you're really careful, you could use it to 20 gigahertz. The way the adapter works on the is laid out on the two ends, that would be the limiting factor. Your adapter is a great big round device where you can put multiple things on the end, stick them out with a tight band, UHF, SMA, whatever, and that has a certain frequency limit. But no, that slotted line is so well designed, it's not going to radiate. Now let me give you another example that demonstrates the principle. Of the 15 different kinds of transmission lines that exist, one of the really nice ones that I've worked with is called tri-plate strip line. You've got an upper flat plate, a lower flat plate, the two of them parallel to each other with a certain spacing. Quite often it's done with double, a pair of printed circuit boards. And you've got a strip of material going down the center. That's called tri-plate strip line. And by changing the spacing between the plates and the width of the strip down the center, you can make any impedance you want from 1 ohms to probably a couple hundred ohms of transmission line with tri-plate strip line, and it's beautifully well shielded. Now, you would think you should put some copper tape around the outer edge of these two flat plates that are making a tri-plate strip line to stop it from radiating. You would think you should do that. You don't have to. One of the magic rules of thumb of tri-plate strip line is that you get 27 decibels of shielding for every ground plane spacing. If my upper plate and my lower plate were, let me pick a number, 1 centimeter apart, and I now put some signal down that strip of the center conductor, and I start measuring the signal that's squirting out of the edges of this tri-plate strip line. If I had 1 centimeter of spacing, and if the outer edge is 1 centimeter away from the strip going down the center, that signal out there, in the worst case, would be 27 dB weaker. If I've got 2 centimeters of spacing between the center conductor and that outer edge where the slot is, I would get 54 dB of attenuation. 27 dB per ground plane spacing is the shielding you get with tri-plate strip line. As you can tell, your Hewlett-Packard 805 is the first cousin of a tri-plate strip line. It is...
Repeater, timeout.
It is strip line, except for the fact that the center conductor happens to be round instead of a flat strip. Does it matter? The RF doesn't see that. Depending on the dimensions, spacing between the two plates, and the diameter of that rod, you set that up correctly, and it's exactly a 50 ohm transmission line. You could, if you wanted to, you could unplug that round rod that's in the center, and you could substitute a strip of material in there that, if you choose the right width of that material, you would again reestablish a 50 ohm tri-plate strip line. So, until you get to at least 10 gigahertz in your situation, John, that's not going to radiate. That's a beautifully well-shielded structure, even though your eye can easily look down that slot and look at that center conductor. Ain't that crazy? KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, I'll tell you what I experienced. I had my sniffer probe, which is just a coil going to an instrument, and I had a 1 gig signal going down that, the slotted line I was feeding with a 1 gig signal. And I noticed when I dropped, what looks like a popsicle stick, only it's made out of Teflon, and I dropped that down in there, I saw indication on the meter. And I took it, and I started tapping on that center rod. Okay, sure enough, if I wedged it into the 5 millimeter space between the wall and the center conductor, twisted it, I would notice an indication. So what I did was, I hooked it up to my VNA. Hold on, let me let it drop. I hooked connected to DNA, and I looked at the S12 and S21, and I found out that if I strummed it like a guitar, you took that and just flicked it like you would do with your fingernail on a guitar string, the vibration of that rod would drive the DNA crazy. It would travel in a circle around the 50-ohm part, and of course it would indicate on the meter too. So that's how critical that spacing is.
When you were doing that, your sniffer probe was down inside of a certain depth of that strip line, of your slotted line.
No, Dick, it was laying on top of the opening, just right on top of it, but it wasn't in the channel.
How many dB of loss did you see between the signal in the center conductor and your sniffer? If you had calibrated the two, I bet you there was a good number of dB of loss there, John. Go ahead.
The gain set up all the way. I don't know how many dB. I would suggest it was at least, compared to the signal, probably negative 20.
That's the right number. So 20 dB of loss when you did this disturbance of the semiconductor. And so, as I said, you have to launch a differential voltage between those two vertical plates in order for the slot to radiate. And there's multiple ways you can launch that signal. Pushing the semiconductor off to one side, strumming it like a guitar string, is one way. You can make it differential. You can launch a differential voltage without even moving the rod, just by changing the dielectric constant between semiconductor and the left-hand plate versus semiconductor and the right-hand plate. When you took your Teflon popsicle stick and stuck it down inside without even pushing the semiconductor off to one side, you're adding dielectric material between the semiconductor and one of the plates that is electronically offsetting the plate. Even though physically the semiconductor is in the exact same place, electronically you have offset it. You can do the exact same thing by taking a sheet of Teflon and sliding it down in there between the semiconductor and one of the plates. It is electronically offsetting the semiconductor, and now you're launching a signal between the two plates. Do you see the principle there, John? This is a beautiful example of three-dimensional electronics, if you know what I mean. KC2 WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Exactly. I had a very interesting conversation. I think it was last night with Eric. I found that I had a piece of compressed paper that was approximately an eighth-inch thick, 2 inches wide, about 6 inches long. When I had a signal going in there, 0 dBm, going into the line at 1 gig, I think it was, and I was looking at the detector output of the carriage. I aligned that carriage to where I had as close to zero signal on my spectrum analyzer. As soon as I took that cardboard and slid it between that 5 millimeter space between the rod and the wall, I noticed an increase of 20 dB. And from like 78 dB, which was in the noise floor, but it was very low, it would go up to 58. Yeah, exactly.
What is the permittivity of the tone versus permittivity of air?
Stand by now before we get into another subject. Were you using the slotted line with a short or an open at the end? Were you intentionally making standing wave ratio?
Yes, it was open, Dick.
And you said you had used the original carriage with its probe, and when you positioned that probe to a place where you've got a null, that null is only true for that particular length of line inside of the strip line, inside of the slotted line, between the probe and the output open circuit. If you do anything between the probe and the output open circuit by putting a piece of dielectric material in there, you're changing the velocity factor of that signal going down the semiconductor. Therefore, what used to be a null is not the null anymore. You've changed the number of wavelengths between the probe and the output open circuit. You see what I'm saying on that one there, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, that's what I was discussing with Eric, because I didn't understand how I could get a 20 dB increase. Where was it coming from? Was I coupling more energy?